FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is 12/9/2020. Well, it's said that there's a fine line between genius and insanity. And perhaps in these days where we're seeing insanity all over the place, maybe the ability to kind of tap into your inner nut job, your inner craziness, will give you the perspective necessary to broaden your horizons, to get out of your rut, and to find other things to do to make income and to make a successful life, whether it's relationships or interests or whatever. I'd like to know your thought. Why don't you send me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. Right now we have Dr. John Huber, clinical psychologist from Austin, Texas. And Dr. Huber, insanity. What is the definition of insanity?
Well, you know, we hear the colloquial definition of doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different outcome is insanity. The reality of it is insanity is a legal term. It's actually not a mental health term. Insanity is a legal term, and it means not knowing right from wrong at that moment, at any particular moment. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're irreparable or that you have even a mental health disorder. It can be induced by drugs. It can be induced by anger. The problem is, in the legal world, if you're going to use that as a defense, now you've got a whole nother set of things going on. You have to prove that it's not just because of that one instance. And you have to have a long history of mental health for it to even be considered a potential defense for you. So, you know, losing it in one moment, we do kind of take that and we talk about killing somebody in hot red blood instead of, you know, cold blooded murder. Hot blood means it was a totally emotional and knee jerk. And oftentimes, if you do that, you end up going with something like manslaughter. Okay, I caught this person doing X, Y, and Z to a good friend of mine, and I defended that person, but I didn't have to necessarily kill them. But because I was so upset, I couldn't stop myself. That kind of a thing. So it's not truly mental health as far as, you know, it's not schizophrenia, it's not bipolar, it's not depression.
All right. So, but in the medical profession, so you don't just say somebody's insane, come up with a diagnosis of a condition that is causing them to not act rationally, correct?
Absolutely. And that, you know, pretty much covers almost the gamut. I mean, there's, you know, if all the dominoes line up right and they fall, you know, just about anybody can be in that situation, even somebody who doesn't have a diagnosable disorder.
Right. So what is the difference then between a mental illness or whatever and a personality disorder? Is a personality disorder a form of mental illness?
Yes. Personality disorder is a situation where your personality is such that you're going to, for example, somebody who has borderline personality disorder, that basically is somebody who does not have a very good identity, no sense of self. Their ego is in flux all the time. So they tend to base their self-worth on other people's perception of them and what they perceive those perceptions are. So it may not even be an accurate understanding. But what we also see with those people who are borderline, they can't understand that, for example, somebody can disagree with me and still like me. So if you don't disagree with me, or if you won't do what I need, then you obviously are evil and don't have anything. And that's a really extreme look. And that's kind of what we see with all of these, because at some point in life, just about every symptom of every mental health condition is an adaptively appropriate behavior. For example, think of schizophrenia with hallucinating and thinking that there's somebody, you know, helping you do your board meeting and that nobody else on the board can see them, you know, and you're hallucinating this person. Well, there's a point in childhood development where that individual kid may have an imaginary friend, and we consider that normal, you know, especially if that imaginary friend eventually grows up and is no longer there.
Well, it's funny when you said that you disagree with a person and they think that you're evil and out to get them. Kind of reminded me of my ex-wife.
Well, you know, and that is, you know, that's another thing I deal with, you know, when I'm in court working with divorce cases and child custody. A lot of times somebody is just so upset because, you know, the other person may have gotten accustomed to the idea that the marriage is over years before they actually file the divorce paperwork. So they've already kind of dealt with that shock and awe. And the other person is trying to figure out why, because you never said anything to them and they had no clue. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like, hey, you know, I must, you know, this person must just be delusional and crazy. And they turn it into anger and fear instead of dealing with the shock and frustration.
All right. So for personality disorders, there is no chemical treatment. There is no therapy that works, but we got like these emerging medicinal hallucinogens, I guess, that that indigenous peoples, Native Americans, et cetera, have used for years and years. They show hope for treating these conditions that we can't get elsewhere.
You know, I think they do. I think we know they do really good for things like depression and anxiety and you know, if they're used appropriately. And that's the problem. You know, we're not sitting around partying with our friends and taking mushrooms. That's not a therapeutic use of them.
Are you sure?
That's pretty much, I mean, because I've had a lot of people come into my practice who have been doing things like that. And although it may help them in the moment, and the next couple of days, it's not a curative process. And until we start adding appropriate psychotherapy with that and setting, you know, boundaries and limits, all of a sudden they start having long-term benefits from those, whether we're doing it through research or we've got certain, you know, access because, you know, we've been given permission because it's a university study or something like that. And it's really amazing because things like ketamine are actually legal and we use them off label, and people are induced into some sort of shamanistic experience. And I'll use that because, you know, the hallucinations and things like that, we're not talking about, you know, Timothy Leary when everybody's getting LSD and, you know, you have a 4-hour half-life. So that means you're sitting there for 8 hours tripping. You know, with ketamine, you have anywhere from 5 to 15 minute half-life, depending on how your body processes it. So everything's done in 45 minutes to an hour. And you can sit there and then process with a therapist what's been going on. And you can have really long-term positive change in that. And everything from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, to drug addictions. And, you know, the Veterans Administration has been using ketamine for a long time. It's such a safe medication that a lot of the medics carry it in their packs because they don't have to worry if they give you too much of it. You know, you're gonna go to sleep. It's an analgesic, but they don't have to worry about your respiratory suppression. They don't need to intubate you and put you on oxygen like that. Your body continues to breathe on this medication, so it has fewer side effects. But psychedelically, if you give the patient the right amount, they can have that really intense psychedelic experience, and they can process things. And you know, we talk off the air about changing your perspective and seeing that there's another possible reality out there. And that is awakening for a lot of people. And all of a sudden they start realizing that, hey, I don't have to see things this way. You know, my world is changed by my perspective. And so why can't I start working on that perspective?
And that is a very shamanistic view of things, that it's your perception that determines your reality. So for people really that got these personality disorders and they take one of these hallucinogens, and then it kind of opens them up. I guess what I was going to ask you is, somebody told me recently that the average person has 60,000 thoughts per day, that a large percentage of them are negative. Is that where like all this comes from?
I think some people do have that negative shift, but not everybody. You know, I mean, a lot of people walk around and they always see the silver lining to that cloud, you know, and that's where we start changing. I mean, you drive down the road and somebody cuts you off and you have this, I can just stick a pencil in that person's eye, you know, but you don't do it. But the person who doesn't have those limits and controls and all they think of is harming people, at some point they're going to do it, you know. And, you know, personality disorders, we typically tend to perceive them as something that's really a kind of a permanent state. And my experience here, let me talk a little bit. When I give an IQ test, somebody who's 7 years old, I can pretty much predict what their IQ is going to be when they're 18 or 19 years of age within plus or minus 5 points, unless you have like head trauma or brain damage. And you can do that through, you know, anoxia, a lack of oxygen. You can, you know, again, you know, concussions cause brain damage. But even if you have that brain damage, if I assess your personality, you know, 20 years later, even with, say a traumatic brain injury, parts of your personality are still going to be there. The things that you laugh at, the type of humor you like, it may be degraded as far as, you know, you went from college level humor to back to 5-year-old humor, but the same kinds of concepts are pervasive. So our personality is much more resilient even than our IQ is. And if we think about that, what we have to start doing then with personality disorders is teaching people that, hey, you know, society doesn't necessarily benefit or like your personality. So we've got to teach you how to cope if you want to maintain that job, if you want to be the vice president of a company. You know, you may not fit in. And things like borderline personality disorder, we talked about earlier with the weakened ego and that deficit, you know, you can teach people that even though you're having these thoughts that they don't see any worth in you, you don't have to respond that way. So we can teach behaviors. It doesn't mean their thought processes are going to change. What we're seeing with some of these psychedelics and some of the theory behind these psychedelics is that things like antisocial personality disorder, we may actually change that person's perspective enough so that they actually learn to empathize with other human beings, theoretically. And I've seen case examples where they've made changes like that, but I haven't seen the studies yet. I mean, we don't have the random sampling and going into example and finding antisocial people, which typically would mean like, hey, we get a whole cell block and we're going to give them all these psychedelic experiences and then assess their personality afterwards. All of a sudden you start seeing secondary gains for these prison inmates for taking psychedelics and things like that. So it's really hard to get that through a human subjects committee and do that kind of real research. So we have to look at case by case studies. And, you know, I know I've had people who had, you know, rap sheets as long as my arm. And I've had, after we go through for a different reason, we treat them with psychedelics through our physicians, and we give them a very intense thing, say, to deal with alcoholism or something like that. And then, you know, a month later, I get a call from somebody in the family, like a wife or a parent, saying, what did you do to my spouse or my child? And I go, what do you mean? And they're like, well, you know, our son's trying to learn to ride bicycle. He fell, skin up his knee. And normally before he went to your treatment, he would have been yelling and telling him to suck it up and all this. But instead, they're sitting on the curb crying together.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting that you can treat things like this. I mean, I've known people with narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, borderline, and one of my best friends, until I realized it one day, was a sociopath. And, you know, he was like not a harmful one in terms of violence. Like, I couldn't see him, you know, coming in and going postal and killing off the whole office. But, you know, he was a pathological liar. And yeah, he would just say things that he said before, which I knew he didn't. And, and you know, like you get sucked into their delusions when you're close to them. He was really, he was really a great guy. But finally, I just realized that I had to extricate myself because he just, it wasn't a healthy relationship.
Absolutely. And, you know, and those kind of relationships are kind of scary, too, because the really good sociopaths, You know, they make you feel like you have known them your whole life, even if you just met them 5 minutes later. And it's pretty scary thing, because, you know, I've seen people who tell their whole life story and intimate secrets to these people. The person walks away and I walk over there and said, "Who is that?" And they go, "Oh, I think his name's Bob." And it's like, what? You just told him all this stuff. You basically gave him your bank account number, your password to, you know, your savings account. What? And you don't even know the guy's name. But it's like I've known him my whole life, but you still don't know his name. You know, I've heard of people getting married like that, but come on.
Yeah. Trying to educate people about the dangers of sociopaths, I think until, and these other people, because they're all related, right? It really is difficult until you encounter one and you really get abused by the person to really understand what's at stake here.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Arcana Silver is on the verge of bringing the world's highest grade silver mine into production. The Revenue Virginius mine in Colorado has proven and probable silver reserves grading nearly 37 ounces per ton silver, with all-in sustaining production costs of only $8 per ounce of silver. The mine is fully funded and permitted with infrastructure already in place and has announced production will commence in 2021. Achieving successful production should result in a significant upward share price re-rating on the Lassonde curve. Arcana trades under the ticker AUN in Toronto and AUNFF in New York. To learn more, go to arcana.com. That's AURCANA.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Well, and there's a lot of really serious stuff at stake in this kind of situation. You know, there's no test for sociopathy, being a psychopath or a sociopath, which, you know, we kind of use those interchangeably. One of them's an older school terminology and the other one is more modern. But what we find is that they meet the qualifications for antisocial personality disorder, which we can test for. But then they have involvement with police and they have records, you know, police records and things like that. The really, really good ones, but also that are really, truly tainted with evil, become the Ted Bundys of the world. And the reason why they're so good and they become a serial killer versus a mass murderer or just a homicidal maniac or murder is the really good ones are so smart that they're able to keep doing it over and over and over and not get caught. The other ones are kind of your average intelligence people who have those symptoms of antisocial personality, but they get caught. They're not quite as smart as the Ted Bundys or the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world. I mean, you have to realize these guys walked in and out of police custody essentially multiple times. Jeffrey Dahmer had a minor that was with him, and he just he was able to just take him and had him stripped naked, basically, and kept him isolated in his apartment. The kid escaped, ran down the street at night. Two police officers in a patrol car pulled him over. Jeffrey Dahmer came down and convinced them to give this naked minor back to him.
Yeah, it's insane. Talk about insanity.
Insanity. Absolutely insane. And he was so smooth, so smart, so sharp, and actually only wanted to protect himself. That was the whole thing. He ended up killing the kid that night, you know, but he wanted to protect himself. And wow, think of how talented, you know, it's evil. Don't get me wrong there, but how talented he was able to convince two other grown adult human beings whose job it is to stop crime. They have been trained more than anybody else in lying, how to perceive or interpret lies and understand people are lying, and to look at crimes. They saw this crime going on and he convinced them it wasn't.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's shocking. So getting back here, hallucinogenics, psychedelics, they're kind of entering a new era for treatment. And I know you're very optimistic about them.
Oh, absolutely. Extremely optimistic about it. In fact, you know, we've talked off the air. I'm in the process of starting a new company to actually get people access to legal psychedelics, in particular ketamine. We're already starting, you know, because now psilocybin mushrooms in the city of Denver and in the state of Oregon are now, you know, not going to be charged. So they're essentially making them legal. So we're looking at and pulling together the data and the research and talking with doctors and seeing what's got to be there. You know, we have four major pharmaceuticals right now that are researching this. Forget the university research that's been going on since the 60s with Timothy Leary and LSD. I mean, they've continued to look at MDMA, at psilocybin, at ketamine, at any type of hallucination or hallucinatory drug that's out there. All of these tend to be scheduled drugs. But the drug companies see that there's something there, too. Unfortunately, I don't think, other than something like esketamine, which came out a couple of years ago, which is a form of ketamine, that they've proved to the FDA actually fixes or in some way, you know, moderates depression. And so much so that they need to allow this hallucinogen to be used as an antidepressant. And the FDA agreed with them and gave them the patent on esketamine. But these things actually work. The research supports them. In a lot of times, these drugs are, after we find the researchers, kind of being ignored because it's not politically correct. It goes against current religious beliefs. Some political atmosphere is not right. Or in some of these situations, the financial atmosphere is not right. In other words, these universities are getting funded by huge pharmaceuticals, and psilocybin mushrooms can't be patented. I mean, they grow on cow patties, so it doesn't help the drug companies. In fact, it can hurt them if we find out that these psychedelic drugs are actually better than the antidepressants we have. That would be harmful to their bottom line. So in a lot of cases, the universities are being told by the drug companies that if you guys, you know, publish this data on psychedelics, we're not going to continue our funding. You can do all the research you want with them. Just don't let, you know, the communities out there that can actually change something about this know about that through publications, peer-reviewed journals, and things like that.
Well, it's like the COVID-19. We know for a fact that that vitamin D helps prevent it and helps treat it. And we know that zinc as well, and a couple of other supplements out there that are very effective. But how much profit is there in vitamin D and zinc? There's none. You buy this stuff. I bought a 2-year supply of vitamin D. I think I paid $12 or $13.
Absolutely. You know, vitamin D, vitamin C, and zinc, those three naturally occurring minerals and vitamins, you know, they are essential in fighting all viruses. We've known this for decades. And if what are we doing right now? Vitamin D is made up through the skin from sunlight. So naturally occurring in your body. So that means you have to be outside and you have to do it without sunscreen. Sunscreen actually blocks the right UV rays.
Correct. Yeah.
That actually, so if you put on your sunscreen and go outside, you know, you're not going to get the vitamin D production that you need. And that leads to a whole other series of things. But we know in this country, we are vitamin D deficient. So everybody goes, how come America has such a bad situation? Because we're so worried about things like skin cancer. We coat ourselves in all these sunblocks and go outside when we do go outside. And then so many people now are addicted to their screen time. They're not going outside anyhow. So you got two things going against us, and we're not producing that vitamin D. And so we are deficient, and we're vulnerable then. We're immune compromised, not because our immune systems don't work, but because they don't have the proper components to allow them to work. And we wonder why, how come America, there's something wrong with our medical community, because it's not the medical community. It's the, I'm a capitalist at heart. But it's the capitalist community who tell you that never go outside without your sunscreen, and because they make money selling their zinc oxide on a topical format so that you don't get, you know, skin cancer.
Oh, I hate to admit this, but I never wear sunblock ever. And I have a convertible, but I don't go out for long periods of time, but I just don't believe in the stuff. Maybe it will help your skin age better. I won't doubt that.
Well, but see, men should moisturize. We never do, but we should moisturize. And in fact, I started moisturizing about 2 years ago, and I do it every day. Basically, I just put, you know, skin lotion on, you know, and it improves the vitality, the elasticity of your skin. and all those kinds of things. You know, I don't wear sunscreen either. But what we're talking about being outside for periods of time, less than 30 minutes at a time, you know, all you need is a good 30 minutes out there and you produce enough vitamin D for the day. So get outside. You know, they're telling you to cluster yourself inside and stay away from everybody. That's not what we need to do with viruses. We need to be in the sunlight and have that 6 foot distance away from everybody if it makes you feel better. But get outside and get your skin exposed to the sun. 20, 30 minutes. If you have really light skin and you burn really easy, then put the sunscreen on after you go outside, because it takes about a half an hour for your skin to absorb it and for it to be effective as a sunblock. So you're getting your 20 to 30 minutes, and then you're keeping yourself from burning at the same time. And what we're also finding out is a lot of these sunblocks, guess what they do? They cause skin cancer.
Yeah, I believe it. That's craziness. Yeah, well, it's always the things that you think you know.
Insanity.
You don't know. Yeah, that's the definition of insanity, listening to these people don't know anything. But hey, so I guess how would you know, short of seeing somebody like you, that that these hallucinogens might actually help you?
Well, you know, if you have a history of psychotic events, like you do hallucinate on your own, you do have delusions, they're going to make your situation worse. Okay, so one of the things we do is we rule those type of events out when you come in. We also look at things like that borderline personality. The perspective change is not something you have a problem with. Your whole sense of self is based on how you perceive everybody else and how they think about you. So adding more perspective change actually exacerbates your borderline personality traits. So that also is a rule out. So somebody comes in and we do a psych eval on them, and we see that they have borderline personality disorder, and they're not, at least in my practice, not appropriate, in my opinion, for some sort of psychedelic therapy. We need to use more standard talk therapy, give you some things, maybe some hypnosis to kind of get you to quit flipping to everybody else's perspective and take more of a direct kind of path to that. And that can work for certain people. I'm not going to say that hallucinogens are the panacea, but I know I've looked at data from the VA over 10 years long with tens of thousands of veterans who were treated with it, and 80% of them improved with their depression. 80% of them stopped drinking. 80%, but we went through and using, statistical data and processes, we're able to start seeing trends in there. And then we started, hey, maybe this is something we should be looking at in treatment. So all of a sudden we start looking at the research out there. And again, so much of it's not published in the United States until recently. You can go now and go to Yale and look at their cataloging and see all the research they've been doing and how safe it is compared to things like aspirin. It's really bizarre how safe ketamine is when used under appropriate supervision. But the data goes way back before then. It goes back to the 60s and 70s. Ketamine's been around since 1924. And who's actually done the most research? It actually has come from Europe, in particular Russia. And the problem is getting the Russian technical language translated into English technical language, because it's easy to find somebody who knows the technical language in English and they interpret Russian, but they don't know the technical language in Russia, and vice versa. Wow. So what we ended up doing is we just started finding the researchers and going online and getting emails and emailing them directly in English and or calling them. And lo and behold, so many of them could actually speak English and were fluent and could talk their research in English. All of a sudden, they're giving us directives and how we should look at our patients and how we should dose our patients and things like that. And over a period of several years, we've learned. And one of the advisory boards that I'm on, two of the members are Russian researchers who actually the Russian government under capitalism has banned them from doing any more ketamine research because, again, it's not something that Russian corporations can copyright and patent because it's naturally, you know, it's been out there for so long that all the patents have expired and it's now considered public domain.
So this concept of just doing research to benefit humanity seems to be disappearing around us all over the place, whether it's the U.S., whether it's Russia, Asia. It seems like if there's no profit, then we don't care. And even if the benefits could be dramatic and really positive for society as a whole.
Well, the research is going on. There are researchers who say, no, the potential is great. The problem is it never gets past that publication benchmark. Because, I mean, you think about it. What, you know, NIH has their own goals and objectives, and they, you can look at their grants. What are they looking for? And what do they want to support? Their grants are written in such a way that if you're not taking that angle and perspective, you're not going to get the grant money. So you either have to fund it yourself, find alternative sources of funding, maybe private families or endowments, things like that. But then you're never going to get it published because it doesn't follow the current scientific political genre that's going on at that time. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, I'm a member, I'm not a physician, so I'm not technically a member. I participated in the first ever physicians conference for ketamine. And we brought in all these ketamine researchers from Johns Hopkins, from Brown, from all these, you know, Ivy League, MIT places and things like that. And one of the things that they say is, you know, please, you know, look at my research, use it clinically, use it in your practice. But, you know, I'm not allowed to publish this. My university, you know, I'm tenured and my university has said that, you know, I could risk my tenureship if I go and publish this. So this is for you as a practitioner. But, you know, you're probably not going to see this research out there.
Oh, that's terrible.
At least in the near future. Hey, and it's scary.
Yeah, we just.
And I mean, I did my podcast from the first one, and they would come in and they go, "Wait, you're documenting me saying this? I can't say it. I can't do the interview."
Yeah, Dr. X. You know, and we've seen this just recently with COVID-19. The person over at Johns Hopkins did a detailed study. She was an economist, like 2 advanced degrees, and found that there were no excess deaths from COVID-19 from 2018 to 2020. But that there was a brand new cause of death, COVID-19, but that resulted in people dying from heart attacks, cancer, diabetes, all the leading causes, strokes. They actually went down during 2020, which the logical conclusion to draw from that is that there's a mischaracterization of causes of death.
Right. Look at the language, because they talk about people who die with COVID versus die from COVID.
COVID-related deaths. What's that?
Right. Well, and the CDC clarifies that, and it's still up. You have to go dig for it. But they talk about 6% are actually from COVID of the reported deaths with COVID. Only 6% are actually caused by COVID. And you also look at over 90% of the COVID deaths, whether they're related or actually from COVID, happen after the age of 78 and beyond. So the age life expectancy in this country is 78 years of age. So we're not seeing an increase in deaths because basically that average, the majority of people at 78 won't make it to 79, according to that, you know, that statistical thing. That's there. Right. We know a lot of people. Yeah. So for every 1% of unemployment we have in this country, we have 60,000 premature deaths. Not at 78, but premature deaths, because people don't have an adequate access to appropriate foods, to appropriate preventative health care, to the supplements we're talking about, and to appropriate shelter. So, you know, at one point we were up to 16% unemployment in this country because of the COVID guidelines that our governments enforced. That meant at 16% at 60,000, we're talking about almost 600,000 people will die prematurely because of the preventative things we're doing for COVID.
Yeah, the cure is worse than the disease. Clearly, it didn't mean to go down that path, but just when you were talking about the corona corruption of medical research that
it's the same. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we're dealing with. And that's like the perfect example of it, because Johns Hopkins shortly thereafter took that research down, but the miracle of the internet, it was archived for the world to see. Anyways, right. Well, we got to go now. So just tell us, Dr. Huber, where do we connect with you? How do we find out more about this ketamine thing? And well, whether it's right for you or not.
Well, what I'd like to encourage everybody to do, I mean, you can find me on you know, social media things, but I'd like you to check out tripsitter.clinic. And that's tripsitter.clinic, clinic. And you can start seeing what we're doing. Actually, you know, we should be going live any time now. You can register if you're interested in it. Within 60 days, we should be nationwide if everything goes as planned.
All right.
So if you're interested in ketamine and using it, we use it for pain. It's amazing pain reduction and for other psychological ills right there. So,
all right. Hey,
check it out.
We really appreciate you coming on. Any questions for the good doctor or myself, email us kl@carrylutz.com and make sure you leave your comments, like, share, subscribe, wherever you're listening to this, whatever platform, whether it's YouTube or podcast, please like, share, and subscribe. It really helps us a lot. Doctor, we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.